Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Sean Ray with us. And we're going to talk about why we should target Muslim communities. Listen to the words, Muslim communities. And noteworthy here that Sean inherited from his parents a remarkable lineage of Christian, Hindu, Sikh, Muslim, Jewish, Tibetan, Chinese ancestry, and is due in large part to his having his multi. I can't even say that word. It's a big background. How are you? Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Michael. I appreciate you having me.
Oh, and thank you. And you are also a Muslim. You were born in Pakistan. And the real question here is this. We talk about terrorism and there are people who target the Muslim community. Now, obviously, we know, and I'm not trying to be politically correct because I'm not and I probably never will be, that not every Muslim is a terrorist and not every Muslim wants to kill anybody who's not a Muslim. But I really believe in my heart of hearts, a lot of the things that you have to say really comes down to it. If we want to fix the problem, it's got to come from the Muslim communities where some of that terror is starting from. Now, what's your take on this?
Well, as another part of my background, I was raised in Abbottabad, Pakistan. That's where bin Laden was shot and killed.
Yeah.
So, and I just was there in April burying my dad over there because he just died. But my point to you is that having lived in Pakistan for the first 18 years of my life and being here in the United States as an American citizen, yes, I can understand why the West is concerned about Muslims and, as to what's been happening, because most of the terrorist acts that are taking place at the moment are by Muslims, and so I can understand that. You know, I mean, I feel uncomfortable if I see Muslims in an airplane I'm in suddenly decide that they all want to pray on the airplane, or because that's not normal even in the country that I come from and the places I've been to, but it can obviously spread fear in the West. And the other situation is that just in Pakistan they had the Muslim Eid, which is Eid al-Fitr, which is like the Christmas of the after fasting of the Muslims. And in Pakistan alone, they had the same Christmas on three different days. That means that the Muslims in Pakistan couldn't decide which day their Christmas was going to be in. So if just the Muslims in Pakistan can't decide what their Christmas is going to be, their Eid will be, then we can understand that, we need to have the Muslim decide as to, what kind of a face do they want to portray to the world, because obviously, all is not the same. I'm saying to them, they need to get themselves to figure out, what do they want? Do they want Sharia law? They don't want Sharia law. They want to have a caliphate. They don't want to have a caliphate. And especially to the West that has Muslims here, obviously the West is concerned, as to what do these Muslims want? But all I can tell you is this, is that in America alone, there happen to be 7 million Muslims. Now, if you ask anybody, and say, okay, out of 100 people of any race, caste, creed, color, gender, orientation, isn't there at least one human being that belongs to a mental hospital? And most people will tell you yes. They'll say, oh, no, there may probably more than that. But let's say just one person, out of 100 human beings, belongs to a mental hospital. That means out of 7 million people in this country right now in America, that means there are 1% of 7 million is 70,000. That means there's 70,000 possibly crazy Muslims here that could cause us harm, and it took us less than 50 to plan the attacks on the World Trade Center, and they came from outside the country. So what my point I'm trying to tell people is that, look, 99% of the Muslims in this country, more than that, are actually law-abiding citizens. They just want to live their lives and, go about their daily business. It's the radical elements. And now that means that the European Americans that obviously are in this country, or African Americans, they can't tell which one of those 7 million people, 70,000 of them, are crazies or not. Only the other Muslims, 6,930,000, can find out who the bad guys are. And if you ask Homeland Security and deal with our intelligence agencies, they'll tell you that 40% of attacks that could have taken place have been stopped because uncles, aunts, brothers, sisters, wives, you know, have said to the Homeland Security, look, this guy is going to plan something bad. So my point is that, you know, we should be having something like what they call neighborhood watch, where the point is that the Muslims, I can tell you, assure you, I speak to Muslims all day long, and I work with them. I work with a whole bunch of different people. You know, they want, they know that they don't want any radical people in there, because the first people that get ostracized are the Muslims if anybody in the Muslim communities do something wrong. So they are very, very willing to be able to, you know, step forward and do things, you know, and to find out who those radical elements are. Now, if we all post, you know, pose the fact that, you know, all Muslims are here to have Sharia law, and they all want to destroy the United States and don't think the Constitution trumps everything else, then what's going to happen is you're going to have apathetic Muslims that are not going to be able to watch what's going on, because if you always, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So the bottom line is, why don't we work with the Muslim people and have them find the bad guys like they already are, and let's have good relations, because that's only the way that we're going to be able to resolve this problem. If we always say that all Muslims are bad, that's not going to help any one of us.
No,
because our kids go on the same buses, they might blow up. Our people, you know, Americans are, we're and the Muslims also have people that are in buildings, and a lot of Muslims also died in the World Trade Center.
Yeah, but Sean, how do we bring this to the public attention? When I say how do we bring it to the public attention,
Michael, you're doing it right now. We're talking about it.
But there are people.
You know, I mean, this is my, just in the last 2 weeks, this is my fourth radio show. Yeah. And there are a lot of people, the FBI, the CIA, this all. Well, did you know that, if your listeners may not know this, but there are many, many Muslims that are also in Pakistan that don't believe that the Ground Zero mosque, which actually is not on Ground Zero, should be built. They don't believe it should be built where it's being built, simply because they feel that if the sensitivities of the Americans are such that, that they don't want a Ground Zero mosque for whatever reason, then don't build it. Build it somewhere else. Even my late father believed in the same thing. And many Muslims I talk to believe that. Plus, like just about 2 weeks ago, there were Muslims in a, like a Six Flag, place, taking those rides, having rides on in New York, and the police officers asked them to remove their headdress,
well,
you know, because
yeah, that was safety,
it's a security risk.
Yeah.
Beg your pardon?
John, that was about safety. That was a safety issue.
That's a safety thing. So people called it Islamophobic, and I say, hey, they would have done that to a Jewish person wearing a cap or a cowboy, a person wearing a hat or something like that. So it was not Islamophobic. So what I'm saying is that both sides, you know, Muslim leadership also needs to look at the situation, understand why the, you know, Americans are afraid. I mean, you know, of Muslims. I mean, it's understandable.
Absolutely, there's no question about it. And I really believe that you've got a point. It's got to start from the Muslim communities, and at least allow everybody else to see that when you become an American, you're an American, and this, these other acts, it doesn't cut it here. And as a matter of fact, with Sharia law, and based on the way that many people have learned to live that are Muslim in the Middle East, you come to a country to get away from that. That's why they came here, to get away from it.
Yep,
and
exactly.
Why would you come here to try to make this place like what you left? I think that's really the question, and that's something that I think a lot of people have got to straighten out. The father that killed his daughter, you know, within the last year or so, he went to court, obviously. The point of contention is there is a culture here, and if you're going to come and live here, you've got to live by the culture.
I absolutely agree with you, and believe me, most Muslims I speak to believe in the same thing. I mean, look, I'm an American citizen. I don't consider it my right to be in this country. I consider it a privilege that the people of America and our Constitution has given me to be able to be a U.S. citizen. I've been here for over 35 years now, but the bottom line is that I consider it as a privilege, And I'm a very, very patriotic American, and I absolutely agree that, you know, the onus is on the Muslims here to show the American people here that they're not here to do any harm, that they're also patriotic Americans. You know, I mean, well, why don't we have Muslims go to the Saudi embassy and the Pakistan embassy and stuff, say, look, for every mosque that we build here in the United States, we need to have a mosque built in Saudi Arabia or elsewhere, because we need to give the same respect to the Christians that the Christians are allowing us to have here. Now, when's the newest mosque that's ever been built in Pakistan or Saudi Arabia or in the Middle East? You know, a church. You know what I'm saying, too? So we need to do the same kinds of things. If the Muslims or anybody that comes here, whether people from Latin America come over here and they want to have, you know, Spanish as a second language or whatever it is, they should also realize that, you know what, they're here as a privilege to be over here, and they've got to follow the rules. We can't have anybody be here as illegal immigrants, whether they're from South America or they're from Pakistan, from anywhere.
No, Sean, let me hold you up.
We have to have the rule of law in this country.
Okay, let me hold you up. We're starting to run out of time, but let me make this suggestion. I happen to be Jewish, and I happen to completely, totally agree with what you have to say. So why don't we bring you back on the air time to time? Radio Suzy will get a hold of you. Let's keep everybody addressed and updated on what's going on. And I'm in your corner with this thing. I think your idea is great, and the word should get out.
Absolutely. And if people want to see my website, or they can go to SeanRay.com.
Wonderful. Okay. Hey, Sean, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Looking
thank
forward
you.
To having Bye-bye. You on again.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Far away places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is. So why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star.
Hello, Michael.
Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lover.
Misty Oaks with us is a magna cum laude graduate of North Carolina Central University School of Law. She operates her own law practice, the Oaks Firm in Atlanta, where she's most passionate about loan modification and foreclosure defense. She was featured in the Atlanta area magazine, People You Need to Know. Part of her job as an attorney, entrepreneur, speaker, and radio personality, the Misty Oaks Experience, is to break down the law to the general public in a way that's both accurate and entertaining. An expert in civil, criminal, and real estate law, Misty is available, and here she is right now. Misty, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. Misty, when it comes right down to it, most people have no idea what the dynamic of a jury is. We take a look at it and we say, well, you know, there's 12 people of your peers and they were chosen and they have to be on jury duty and they're going to decide, quote unquote, life or death, good or bad, about someone who has been accused of something. Now, the one thing I want to touch on before we go farther, years ago, I remember there was something that was addressed on the show was jury nullification. The power is in the jury. Is that so today?
The power is in the jury. Well, I think that is mostly true. However, with the media and people being tried in the media prior to even getting before the jury, I think that the people generally have a trial a lot of times before the trial in the courtroom. And also, too, another aspect of that is that the jury certainly has power. I mean, that is the essence of the American justice system. But a side note to that is that a jury's decision can always be overruled by a judge. And so that's an important point to keep in mind. So yes, juries have power. They always have. They always will, as long as this is an American democracy. But they are, human beings that are often influenced by the things that they see and read and hear and the people that they talk to, that listen to the media. before they even get into the jury room. So that's also an important consideration.
You look at high drama, high maintenance, and some of these trials, Misty, they're almost like watching a movie. And I guess the most famous one right now has got to be Casey Anthony. To this day, I have no idea how she walked away scot-free, and she probably will. But when it really comes down to it, it has to be that decision without a reasonable doubt. And they had reasonable doubt. There was a month that went by or so where her child was missing, the kids out partying and so on and so forth. And yet at the same time, they said she didn't do it. How did they come to a conclusion like that?
Oh, man, I got to tell you, that is, I think, going to be the question for a lot of law school classes all over the United States. It's really two parts. First of all, the prosecution has to prove each and every single element of a charge beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's not just murder generally, it's malice aforethought, it's intent, it's substantial steps. So it's every single element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. And really, they didn't have it, in my personal opinion. I thought this all throughout the trial. They do not have enough for murder. When you don't even have a cause of death, you know, they couldn't even prove what the cause of death was. So how can you prove that somebody intentionally murdered someone? So that was a very difficult thing. And so one other point that I want to make on that topic is that the prosecution could have charged Casey Anthony with a lot of other charges that they possibly could have won on, but they decided to charge her with murder and aggravated child abuse and certain things that they charged her with. For whatever reason, I will never know. But the jury can only convict on the charges that a criminal defendant is charged with. So they may have found that there wasn't enough to convict her of intentional planned out murder or intentional aggravated child abuse, but there could have been some other crimes that there was enough evidence to prove that they just simply could not convict her on because those charges were not presented to them.
But what about unintentional, quote-unquote, if there's such a word, child neglect? I mean, literally, the kid's gone for a month and you don't even report it. Is there something within the law? What do you do with something like that? So what I'm hearing you say, and please stop me if I'm wrong because I'm not an attorney, but what we're saying is there could be six charges that could possibly go against this young woman. But maybe there's only three that we can really charge her with, so we have to go with the three that we think will stick, and even if the other ones would, they're going to drift away. So there's only a certain amount of things you can charge with at that particular trial then.
Well, no. Okay, let me answer the first part of that question because you absolutely hit the nail on the head. I actually just recently got done writing an article about that same exact issue. They could have charged Casey Anthony with child neglect. They could have charged her with child endangerment. If her neglect lasted so long and was so pervasive that the child was murdered or died, while the mother was unaware or didn't report anything for 30 days, that's neglect. You know, if your child is missing for 30 days and you don't say anything, that's neglect, no question about it, you know. So they certainly could have charged her with child neglect, child endangerment, even potentially negligent homicide, where the parent is so negligent that a homicide occurred during the parent's negligence. That could have been a potential charge. Now, in answer to your second question, prosecutors can charge really, and I don't want to say anything they want to with no limits, but they have wide discretion to choose whatever charges or whatever amount of charges, whatever number of charges they would like. And so it's not that they were limited to three charges or six charges or whatever they charged her with. It's that they decided, and really it's a matter of strategy. I don't think their strategy was a very good one, but it's a matter of strategy that they decided they're not going to confuse the jury. You know, if you're charging a defendant with some heavy-hitting felony, murder, you know, aggravated child abuse, serious charges, a lot of times you don't want to add in lesser charges because you don't want to confuse the jury, you know, because a lot of times juries feel like, well, how can we charge her with murder, which is one of the most heinous crimes, and then charge her with a really, like, lesser charge, lesser punishment crime like negligence. You know, the two don't go together, so it makes it difficult for them to decide, you know. So I think it was just a matter of strategy for the prosecution to say, let's just charge her with these, you know, four or five crimes and stick to these, you know, as opposed to including everything.
Okay, Misty, let me ask you this. Now, as an attorney, obviously you're skilled, you're trained, you've been there, you've done that. If we look deep into this thing through your eyes now, what do you find?
Mm-hmm. What do I find, you said?
Yeah. The system.
What do I find? Well, that's an interesting question. I'm working on something called Fair System but Absurd Results. And it's really kind of like a column or an article piece that talks about how I believe the American justice system is fundamentally fair. No question about it. You can look at the justice system in any other country around the world, and the United States American justice system is one of the most fundamentally fair, balanced, and sound anywhere. No question. Sure. But the people working within the system are not necessarily so, and certainly not all the time. And so, therefore, we have been producing a lot of absurd results, and especially lately. I find that we as people are, of course, faulty and opinionated and sometimes discriminatory.
Sure.
And so you have cases like Warren Jeffs, the Texas polygamist leader, who got sentenced to like 100 years in prison for, you know, child abuse or child rape. And I'm not saying that's not a heinous crime. It certainly is. But there are other people that get 7 years for something like that, or maybe 14 years for something like that. But he got 100 years. Now, why is that? You know, because he's a religious leader with a lot of power, a lot of influence, and maybe, you know, the powers that be or the people working within that system didn't like that amount of power and influence. I don't know. You know, and so in any event, and there are many, many cases across the board, you know, many, many, many. Casey Anthony, you know, this case sends a message to people, you know. And so I find that we have a fair system, but a lot of times we don't have very sound or fair results.
Let me jump in just a minute, because what this brings it down to is back to are we a nation of a rule of law or the rule of man, quote unquote? And I think for instance, based on geographical location, based on the kind of population, I mean, he could have been tried anywhere else, and they may have come up with something completely different. And there's no there's no commonality of justice across this country right now. And I think there in and itself, you know, lies the problem. You look at these different people, I give you, you know, O.J. Simpson, whatever it was, the man walked, you know, and it's the same thing with the Anthony case. If you took a look at it and you realistically saw what happened, the guy did it, but he walked for whatever reason why he walked. And I really believe it has to do with the popular opinion of the time of whatever the population is, the geographic location, the culture of the state that they're in. And each state in and of itself has its own culture, which is a derivative of a society. And I think all of those variables go into play when you're dealing with, is somebody going to be guilty or not?
That's absolutely, absolutely correct. And I think you just proved the answer to that question, that this is a society of the law of man, quote unquote, I think, really. You know, and in large part laws are shaped by society. You know, they are constantly evolving. They are living things. They can be amended, you know, changed. We enact new legislation all the time just to keep up with the changing times and the changing mindset and the changing culture in the world that we live in. So certainly law, you know, is fundamentally supposed to be about
like that
fairness.
Supposed to be is good.
We're
supposed to be is good.
Right. Yeah. We're supposed to be.
I know. I love the way you said it. And it makes so, but it does. It's spot on. It hits it. Law is supposed to be. The rule is supposed to be. This is how it should be. It's not always that way.
Right. It's not always that way. Unfortunately so, but I mean, that's, you know, we're dealing with faulty people. You know, people that are fundamentally limited and flawed simply because we are human beings. And so, you know, we try, and I think in this country more so, like I said, than any other country, we get very close very, very close to maintaining balance and justice and fairness. But then you have the unfortunate cases that send really, really not good messages, like Casey Anthony or O.J. Simpson or Warren Jeffs. So,
and by the way, what it boils down to is this. We have created, and I have to say we have created, you and I and everybody here, we're all the same. We've created a society, we're dealing with a society for the most part that's not listened to, not cared about, not encouraged, and for the most part until we need something, you know, and someone needs something of us, let me say it that way, we're forgotten. And we're people who live, we have a freedom of religion, of choice, of opinion, sexual orientation, and on, but you could be sued if you exercise any of them. So isn't that a little bit of contradiction in terms?
I don't know if it's so much a contradiction, so much as it is two sides of the same coin. When you have freedom, you can't really limit. I mean, well, you can. We have to a certain extent. But you have freedom all across the board. I mean, the same way that I'm free to say whatever I want to say or practice whatever religion I want to practice, somebody else is free to call me on that or to file a lawsuit against me on that. I mean, it's really two sides of the same coin to a large extent. In this country, we don't typically really restrict who can sue. I mean, we do have some laws about frivolous lawsuits and, you know, certain things and dollar amounts for different jurisdictions and all that kind of stuff. But really, I could sue somebody for saying anything, you know, that I didn't necessarily like. Would it win? Would it be, you know, meritorious? I don't know. That's a whole other question, you know. But we're free, and thank God for it, you know. But I think that, you know, when you say one group of people is free or a large group of people are free, you kind of have to let that just, you have to let them run with it to a certain extent. You know, you can't say you're free to practice whatever religion and then tell somebody they can't sue you for practicing it on their property or something, you know. And then to answer the first part of your statement, I completely agree with you. Completely, completely, completely agree. You know, the Constitution says that the powers that are not reserved or delegated to the federal government are, you know, reserved for the states or the people. And so that means that the people are supposed to be powerful. The people are supposed to be, have a voice and be thought about and be important and be heard. But a lot of times, you know, the larger government or the quote unquote powers that be don't really focus on us or want to hear from us until it's tax time. You know, until it's time to pay those income taxes, we're not really thought about.
Misty, I hate to do this. We're running out of time now. And I'll tell you what. I like you and I like the way you present yourself. And if somebody wants to sue me for it, go ahead.
I'll protect you.
Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes. My law firm's website is The Oaks Firm, and that's OAKS, like the tree, theoaksfirm.com. And also you can find us on Facebook and or Twitter at The Oaks Firm, and that's OAKS, like the tree. So check us out. We do all sorts of stuff here. So we should certainly be able to help you. And if we can't help you, we can point you in the right direction.
Wonderful. Hey, Misty Oaks, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Good night.
Okay, have a good one. Bye-bye.
Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London.
Hey, Seth, is our guest up?
I'm right here.
Oh, good. Thank you, and I'll introduce you. You know, that I didn't hear that you were here, and if you give me a second, we'll give you an intro that you'll never forget, okay?
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Okay, hold on. Hold on.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Brave and faithful and true, and cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance.
Nina Merritt with us. We're going to talk about writing books, how to write a book, how to do it fast, how to blog a book, and why authors need to blog. Hey, Nina, welcome back.
Thank you, Michael Ray. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
I guess the big question here is, we've been talking about books, we've been talking about writing a book. What is that little light bulb that goes on, that spark, that motivator that causes somebody to actually write a book?
I think it's a variety of things. I think it's a desire to share information. I think it's a sense of purpose that sometimes people need to fulfill. I think sometimes it's a great story that they want to tell or that they need to tell. Or it's an experience that they've had that they have to share or that they want to share. Sometimes, you know, it's just a creative burst. You know, they have an idea for something. For novelists, sometimes it's just they really have this great story, and it's a creative thing that they just need to get out.
You know what I found over the years with all the authors that I've interviewed, et cetera, that, Nina, what stimulates a lot of people to write a book, it's about them, and half the time they don't even know it's about them until they dig into it and take a look at it. I have watched time and again, you know, and I've probed and I've questioned on the air, and it turned out that whatever that subject matter was, even if it was paranormal, even if it didn't even look like this person's life, it was about an experience they had in their own life, and it got externalized.
Well, yeah, I mean, it does get externalized, but to be honest, you know, when we talk about our own experiences, that's usually what brings other people in. That's what makes readers want to read, because they very often have had similar experiences, and they want to know, you know, they relate. They want to read because they relate.
Let me give you a prime example, and this happened on the air, so it's something we can talk about. Do you know who Jackie Michaud is? She wrote The Deep End of the Ocean.
Oh, right.
She, mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Jackie was actually here in studio a couple of years back, and The Deep End of the Ocean was basically about some women who got on a boat, and something happened to the crew, and the pirates were after them, and they you know, survival, and they had to learn very quickly how to be out in that kind of a world and survive. And as we dug and we probed, what we found out was Jackie had been married, and she was a housewife, she was a mom, and he handled the checkbook, and she didn't pay attention to any of that. Well, one day he died. And all of a sudden, she was thrown into the world to survive, and she had to learn how to survive. Very interesting, because when we take a look at our own life experiences, we end up framing it in a different way, and many, many times, not every time, obviously, but many times it comes out in pen, turns into be a book or a movie.
That's right. That's yeah. Very often the case, that we do take what we have experienced, and we turn it into something. I mean, I know for myself that a lot of what I've written comes from my own experiences and my desire to share that with people, that I've learned something, and yeah. I feel that it's a, you know, maybe I'm not the expert on the subject, but I've learned enough that what I can offer is at least a jumping off place for someone else, that they can take what I've learned and they can hopefully use that in their life and move on from there.
You know, that's another reason, interestingly enough, why people write books. Let's say it's a business book. Somebody goes through 20 or 30 years of being in business and has fallen down, gotten back up again, fallen down, gotten back up again. They have been there, done that, quote unquote. Well, somebody in a couple of hours by sitting down and reading the book, can garner everything that person went through in the last 20 or 30 years. You know, why go through all the mistakes if it's sitting, quote unquote, in front of you at the time? And I think that in and of itself, authors do a lot of people a lot of favors that they don't realize that they're doing. Now, brings us to the next part of this is writers. They some of them give up so easily. Why is that? They just don't seem to have the fortitude to stick it out and go the distance.
Well, it's not an easy path. First of all, you know, writing a book as opposed to an article or an essay can take a long time. And sometimes people who have an experience and they want to write about it are not necessarily writers. They just have had an experience or they have an idea or they have information. So writing a book can seem overwhelming to them. And it's also a solitary task. A lot of times we're doing it by ourselves. And so all of that can feel hard. And it can take a long time. Some people are slow writers, or the subject that they have seems to be large and take quite a while to get it down on paper. They can get into overload of information. You know, maybe they've gone and they've done research on what it takes to write a book and what it takes to promote a book. Maybe they've gone to some writing conferences, and they may come back from all of this and think that there's just way too much to know, too much to do, and they get discouraged, and so they quit, and they give up their dream of becoming a published author or of getting their information out there. So they also get stumped by not by the writing part. They may get stumped by the financial part, because a lot of times they need an editor, or if they're going to self-publish, they need an editor and a designer, and they need the promotional help and all of that, and they may get stumped by the financial end of it, and they may decide they just don't have the money to go through with it. So all of this can get them to a point where they just stop and they think it's too much. And then again, they may just feel afraid. It takes them out of their comfort zone. They have to put something down on paper and put it out there where people can read it. And for a lot of people, that's like coming out of your shell and showing yourself to the world.
Let me tell you what two things happened to me. It was very interesting. I looked in the mirror and my hair got a little thinner and grayer. Okay.
Yeah, I know that feeling. My hair's not thinner, but I do have some gray in there.
Oh, I hear you loud and clear. Now, advice, somebody who really dreams of writing and publishing, and they just don't feel like they've got that oomph, that something special to keep them going. What do you say to them?
Well, first I tell them really to commit. To commit yourself to manifesting your dream of writing and publishing a book. And I start on a more kind of woo-woo, airy-fairy plane, and I tell them to use positive thinking and creative thinking techniques. I tell them to continually tell themselves they can do it. You know, I tell them, I know you can do it. Now you have to tell yourself you can do it. And I tell them to visualize their book written, to create maybe one of these vision boards or treasure maps, you know, with all the pictures on it of themselves writing and of their book finished and that kind of thing, so that they have positive reinforcement all the time that they are writing, they are writers, they are authors, and that they can finish their book. Then, on a more practical and active level, I would tell them to get help manifesting their dream if they feel they need help, to get a coach, to get an editor, to get into other groups of writers for support, to find a critique group or to a writer's group, anything like that that will help them feel like they're not alone, that they can get feedback or any kind of help they need. Then, you know, they need to consider whether this is their purpose in life. And this is a real big one. You know, I'd ask them, do you have a message you have to give to the world? Are you committed to helping others, or do you have an important story to tell? And then to focus on that, because this is so important. If you don't fulfill your purpose and you feel this is your purpose, you'll never feel like you've done what you're supposed to do in this life. It's not just about writing the book. It's about fulfilling your potential. I had a friend whose husband came to me. And he was a real estate agent at the time, and he came to me and he said, I have an idea for a book, and I want you to help me with it. and he wanted me to help him edit this book. His name was Colin Tipping. Now, Colin, at the time, had very little money, and as I said, he was just a real estate agent, and he said, I have this great idea, and he already had a title for the book. It was called Radical Forgiveness. Well, we edited the book. We got it totally done. He self-published it. He submitted it to Writer's Digest, to their awards. He won the award for self-published spiritual book, and he got a contract out of that, and he got a huge advance. It's a long story, but in the end, he took the book back and continued to self-publish it. It's a complicated story, not worth getting into, but as a self-published book, Radical Forgiveness went on to sell over 115,000 copies. And he started speaking all over the world, became very successful, very well known, and in the last couple of years, he sold that book to Sounds True. And he's gone on to write two other books, and it's all because that was his purpose. That was his purpose in life to do that. And so he just stuck to his guns. I think he, you know, did all kinds of things to come up with the money for all of this, but it was not just his dream, it was his purpose. And so that's huge for people to really think about, is this your purpose in life, to get your information out there? And, you know, that's what I would focus on.
Yeah, because when you really look at it, what you are doing is you are expressing to an entire world out there, and most people don't get that when they first start. You think about this, if the book takes off, if it really takes off, you could literally be touching a million lives out there. And maybe it's a book about a solution to a problem that someone has. Maybe it's for instance, there's a woman that I know that had lost a child. And it was horrendous for her. There's no question. There's nobody who would want to lose a child. But when she got through it and she began to realize that she could help other people and talk to other moms and dads in that similar situation, she started doing workshops and she wrote a book and so on and so forth. And the book actually became a legacy for that child. You cannot, there is no way that you could ever replace what that child meant to them. But there was also an alternative here, and look at the lives that they touched and maybe the lives that they saved. And 100 years from now, if somebody picked up the book and went through some of the process of how to move through these things, you're still touching a life.
That's right. That's right. Definitely.
Definitely.
And there's so many books like that, that people have had tragedies, and they turn that tragedy into an opportunity to help other people. There's a woman I know that I'm working with, and she came to me. Her daughter actually had an accident where she lost her hand, and the hospital did this miraculous surgery and reattached the hand. And she has become, she suffered post-traumatic stress syndrome from it, and she's become a spokeswoman for the hospital, and she's now writing a book about what happened so that she can help other people who have gone through similar type accidents, not necessarily the hand issue, but who then the parents suffered. The parents struggled with the repercussions and had post-traumatic stress syndrome, and she wants to tell her story but give resources so that they can know how to help themselves when they're struggling. Her daughter rebounded. She was a kid. She rebounded. Sure. She's fine. But she wants to help the other parents.
But there's so much of that that goes on, and if you think about it, how many people that would not have been touched, would not have found a way to mend something that was going on in their life if they had not read a book, listened to somebody talk that had been through there and done that? And it takes a lot of guts for a lot of these people to do it. The emotional side of it will always be there. There's no question about that. And the original meaning will always be there. But if you can step outside yourself for that moment and allow what happened to help someone else, that in and of itself could be a good reason to write a book, because then you get the spotlight off of you, and you get focused on, well, you said it up front, on something called purpose.
That's right. And then, of course, that's what sells books anyway, when you're helping other people. And that's the whole thing. When you can be reaching out to people and offering them something, like I said, that they relate to. When you're telling a story that they relate to, and when you're offering them information or solutions to problems, and that's what's going to make them buy your book. When they're connecting on an emotional level and they're finding solutions to their problems, that's what's going to drive them to buy your book and your services if you're then going to coach around that or whatever it is.
Yeah, and it's the ability to see beyond the surface talk. You know, what do those words mean? How do they touch that person? And I really believe that, and I'm not a writing coach and I never will be one, but my belief inside, in my heart of hearts, is that you have to do the same thing in communication in pen that you have to do verbally. You've got to be able to touch that person's recognition of the subject matter so they resonate with what it is that you're talking about at the time and everybody's on the same page.
Of course. Of course. You have to be clear and you have to have a message, and that message has to resonate with them.
Yeah, and then I've got a second book in mind for me right now. It's called How I Survived the First One and How Long It Took Me in Rehab to Get Back Into My Feet Again.
And How I Survived My Editor.
Yes, when it comes down to it.
Scars I bear from working with my editor.
No, I hope that's not true. Yes, whatever. Well, I'm Jewish. I have to complain. I've got to have some emotion in this. Okay, now when it comes down to it, we got a couple of minutes left. A couple of tips. How do we get a hold of you if somebody wants coaching?
Okay, so a couple of tips. So I had six, and I don't know if I'm going to get through them. I would consider the writing projects and platform building that they've done and see whether it's a priority for them. What projects have they got on their to-do list? Because what happens for a lot of people is that they get caught up and they haven't, they see all these things they have to do in terms of writing and publishing their book, and they get bogged down. And so they have to really make a commitment and decide what is their big rock. There was this woman who said to me one time, you know, I said to her, how do you get so much done? And she said, I always move the big rocks first. So that book has to be their big rock. And they do need to be building platform and all these other things that go with getting a book written and published and all of that, but the writing of the book has to be their big rock, and they have to be committed to it. You know, they have to also sort of overcommit and make sure that they're always putting their fullest energy into that book. They can't let other things get in the way. I have raised, two kids. I had stepkids. I have work. But you have to find a way to make room in your life for this book. You have to seek out the professionals that you need. So if things seem overwhelming to you and you can't get it done on your own, look for the editors, the designers, the coaches, the consultants, whoever it is you need to help you. So I think those would be the biggest ones. You know, if we don't have a lot of time for me to go into the major things, that would be it. Make this book your big rock. Seek out the help you need. And then in terms of finding me, the easiest place to find me is at ninaamir.com, ninaamir.com. If you want to find me at my writing hub, an editing and coaching hub, that is Copyright Communications, Copywright Communications.com.
Nina, we will see you next week.
All right. Thanks so much, Michael Ray. Have a good week.
You too. Good night.
Good night.
So why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, and Paris, and Venice, Tokyo, and Cairo, and Lisbon, and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Places we're longing to see.
Timothy Benarce with us. Dr. Timothy Benarce, PhD, is the author of Great, What Makes Great Leaders Great? What did they do? They did. I can say, what did they did? Radio Susie's over there going, you got this one. I'm going to write a book. Once the intro's over, the rest of the show's great. Great. What makes leaders great? What they did, how they did it, and what you can do to learn from him. He's an accomplished author, a speaker, a radio personality, and a creator of over 125 books, as well as a wide variety of high quality learning content. His latest book is entitled, again, Great, What Makes Leaders Great? What they did, how they did it, and what you can learn from it. And let's say, Timothy, hi, welcome to the show.
Hello, Michael. Quite a tongue twister, isn't it?
I know. Don't ask me to say it four times, but I can do it at least once. By the way, I am really glad you're here. There are people who they want to be great. They want to be a leader. And I think the first step in learning, Timothy, is to define what a leader is and then take it to that next level. So let's start from the base, the scratch, and say, what is a leader?
Well, you know, that's a nebulous term, leadership. What I have found that people that have leadership or that are considered great leaders, they have people that trust them, they have credibility, they're respected, and then depending on if they're in business or in politics, they have an emotional bond and standing with every one of their key constituencies. And everything they do, you know, you hear about vision, you hear about values, you hear about attitudes, practices, everything contributes right to those points. If you don't have trust, you don't have respect, you don't have credibility, you're not going to be a leader.
Now, by the way, I really believe in my heart of hearts, Timothy, that over the years that I've learned one thing. Leadership is an acquired skill. It doesn't automatically happen for people. There's a process to go through, and there are things that you have to know, and it's those things that you have to know are learned, and they're learned not necessarily along the way, but let's say from people like yourself who can look over somebody's shoulder and say, look at this, bring the invisible up to the table, see what those people don't see. So being a leader, number one, it's an acquired skill.
Well, it is and it isn't. I agree to you to a great degree. You know, there's a big argument out there in the research community that leaders are born and leaders aren't trained. I think leadership can be trained, but I think there are certain types of skills and abilities that certain leaders just have. They're just a natural ability that they have in it. Does that make them a great leader? Not necessarily. They might be very charismatic. And my research showed some of the most charismatic leaders that I researched ran their companies right into the ground. But there's certain skills and abilities that develop. They start very early. You start as a child, you know, what you learn from your parents, your teachers, your friends. They're acquired as an adolescent where you're going out and delivering papers, or doing some kind of little work like that, where you're learning discipline and things like that. And then they do build over time. But I agree that a lot of leadership capabilities can be developed.
Well, and most importantly, because I really believe also that somebody can have these basic traits, these innate talents, and that's wonderful. But it's called shaping those talents, because I'm taking a look at, you know, your bio here and the press information. And when you really come down to it, it's your perspectives, you know, regarding what works in leadership, what doesn't work. And that's that, you know, that historic perspective cultivated through extensive research. And I'm reading that, and that's really what it's about. It's a learning process. You take that charismatic person and then you apply some of the techniques to that person. My goodness, you got a winner across the board.
That's true. And these techniques, these attitudes, these skills have to be tested. One thing I've learned in the research, and it really did surprise me, is that almost every leader, maybe there was maybe one or two that didn't, but virtually every leader went through a crucible period in their life, a period of a prolonged time of frustration, adversity, pain, failure. Nothing seemed to work, you know, like everybody's going through today in the economy. And it's those leaders that were able to go through those fires and polish their skills, develop perseverance, develop resolve, refuse to quit, came out ahead so much stronger. And some leaders went through it once or twice. And some of these periods of adversity lasted 10, 12 years. And that really shocked me.
Yeah, but what a wonderful gift when they're done with it, when they had the foresight to get through it. No matter, even if it was 10 or 12 years, as tough as it is to be able to have that something inside, that light, that little flicker of something that allows you to see ahead and then garner all of that information and then take it and then use it for everybody else's good.
That's true. And it comes down from a really deep, deep belief in themselves, a belief in their ideas and belief in their values. You know, something that's deep inside. A lot of it comes down from religious convictions, not necessarily going to church, but having a relationship with an upper spiritual being that gives them the strength. But wherever they pull it from, you know, it gives them, they go through that period, and that I found to be a very, very telling sign of how some of these great leaders ended up evolving into what they were doing. They took the skills that you're talking about. They took the mentoring. They took all that. But then it was put to a test. And when they passed that test, that allowed them really to grow into the next levels.
And then there's a couple of words that you use that are such powerful words, Timothy. It's critical thinking, problem solving. And I think that's your leader. That ability to look not just at the surface of something, beyond the surface of something, to see what lies at that foundation of the meaning process. And I really believe a leader realizes that they have to step outside of themselves and understand that language is not just the way they understand it, but it's the way there's a different meaning for other people. And to take all of that, that's the critical thinking. That's the problem solving when you can get right to the heart of it and work with people. And then they want to work with you because for some reason, whatever it is, you know.
And it comes from all that comes out into passion, where people become passionate. They care about people. They have empathy. They're compassionate about each other. There's so many qualities that come into that leadership equation, and they all go back to that trust, credibility, respect, having a standing with all your, you know, if you're a CEO, with your employees, your vendors, your stockholders, your community. All of these things come to play, and everything you're talking about here contributes back to that.
Sure,
and it's a long process to build that.
Yeah, because if I haven't endured pain in my life in one way, shape, or form, I, in the general sense of the word, if I haven't endured pain, how am I going to recognize it in you and be able to work with it? And I think that's a good quality of a leader when they recognize it, and that those people that are following, whatever that means, but the people that are following realizes that the leader intimately understands what their concerns are. Then the trust is developed because now you have somebody who knows. And I think that's so critically important.
You know, the way I've structured the book, I try to define leadership and the characteristics through the leaders I researched, own words, their own stories, and own experiences. And one that comes to mind is, it was George Westinghouse. He founded Westinghouse Electric.
Yeah.
Very, very accomplished man, one of the most admired people that in my research. But there was a story about he was walking a bunch of very rich executives through his plant, and they were all at that time, this was about the turn of the 19th, 20th century, and they were all dressed in fancy long coats and top hats and the way they dressed back then. And here a young boy was carrying this heavy coil of copper. And he ended up tripping and falling flat on his face, and the copper went all over the place. And everybody stood there and laughed, except Westinghouse. He got on his hands and knees, and he picked up the copper, and he picked up the boy, didn't say a word, and went on his way.
Yeah.
Now, do you think that boy, the rest of his life, didn't remember what George Westinghouse did for him?
You bet. No, absolutely.
And Samuel Gompers founded the American Federation of Labor at the turn of the 20th century. And he said of George Westinghouse, if every businessman treated their employees like George Westinghouse, there would never be a need for a union in the United States. That's how much the unions respected him.
No, absolutely. And wouldn't it be interesting if all of those people that got treated that way would in turn treat somebody else that way? And what a wonderful world we would have. I remember the old days, Timothy. I remember when you walked into a small store, a small market, and they knew who you were. They knew the name of your dog. They knew your mom, your dad, your aunts, your uncles. And if you fell down, they would pick you up and not worry about getting sued. And I really believe not only the leaders who achieve greatness, everybody in and of themselves, if they take on the attributes of what you're talking about, what a change in the culture we would have.
Oh, it's amazing. You know, we talk about the progressive era, you know, starting with Theodore Roosevelt and going on to now where we have, pensions and health care and all these programs for union welfare or employee welfare. And yet many of these leaders, Milton Hershey, H.J. Hines, John Patterson, who founded National Cash Register, William Proctor, who was the grandson of the founder of Procter & Gamble, all brought these programs in the 1870s and 1880s, as did Westinghouse, where they had employee insurance, they had pensions, they had all sorts of facilities places for their employees to go. Patterson at NCR would shut the company down for 2 weeks in August and take all of his employees from Dayton, Ohio, to outside of Chicago. He had a camp spot. He would take everybody for a vacation at $5 a family. But they took care of their employees. You know, at the time, you had other companies that abused people. But the great leaders, a lot of them were very caring and empathetic people that took care. They realized taking care of people, taking care of their employees, what was good business. Their employees were assets. And you look at that attitude today where you have stockholder values, everything stockholder values. And what goes? Well, we're going to fire the employees. We're going to close the plants. We're going to harm a community. These people didn't look at that. They looked at taking care of everything, and the profits followed.
By the way, very important. I want to touch on this. We've got a couple, 3 minutes, and before we end this, the presence of the legitimacy principles endow the leaders with the authority to lead, to manage, to move forward. What are we talking about, the legitimacy principles?
Well, basically, legitimacy is based on a couple of things. When you look at leadership the concept of leadership, we think, Jack Welch or Jeffrey Immelt, you know, they're leaders because the board of directors appointed them. You know, I'm not pointing them out, but just as an example.
Sure.
But they're given authority to lead. Legitimacy has authority, but then it has validity. And validity is something that's not conferred. It has to be earned. And that's basically granted to the leader by his constituencies. That goes back to respect, that goes back to trust, that goes back to an emotional standing with the employees, where the employees have a good relationship with you, the stockholders, whatever. And this is true of a politician as well. You know, do they have respect and credibility with each one of the constituencies they represent in their district or the country or the state? If they don't have credibility, they lose that validity. If they lose the validity, they lose the legitimacy.
Now, and by the way, credibility, legitimacy, validity, all of those steps to get there. I'm going to go all the way back to what we first talked about. We're talking about an acquired skill. Knowing that is
it's
not
something that's earned.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, think about the little boy.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Think about the little boy delivering the newspaper, the little girl. Do you trust him? Do you believe him? It starts way back then.
Yeah, no question about it. But also, they've got to be aware of what they're doing. That's why I love about what you've put together. It causes somebody to take a look at it and recognize there are those things. Even if you've been doing it, how about be intentional about it? I mean, I think that's really what we're talking about. Timothy, we're running out of time. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at, buy the book, find out more?
If they go to whatmakesleadersgreat.com, they can see, they can purchase the book there, but they also can see an executive summary, a sample chapter, the index. They can get a pretty good overview of what the book is about. And if they want to learn what the great principles of leadership are all about and how to achieve them, this will do it. And it does it in the leader's words. It's not my writing a theory. It's what the leaders are saying, themselves are saying they have done and what they can accomplish.
Wonderful. Hey, Timothy, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me, Michael Ray.
Take care. Good night.
Good night now. Bye-bye.
Country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a lover's burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. It's just a dog for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover.
Kevin Bork with us. He is the author of Gilding the Golden Years. He's the owner of Bork Wealth Management. Started his career in 1987. And since that time, he's helped thousands of investors make very wise financial decisions, especially when they were faced with major life transitions. He's been a financial columnist for the Santa Barbara Independent and is regularly featured on KEYT, ABC News as a public speaker. He's helped thousands of listeners become smarter, smarter with their money. And what a great time to hear that. Kevin, I welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we talk about being smarter with your money in today's world, it's got to be a kind of a tough challenge as opposed to what it was like 10, 15 years ago. You know, when somebody comes in, they've got a problem today. There's so many more varied facets of that problem than we had before.
That is absolutely the truth. In fact, our job as advisors, even from 5 years ago, has become much more difficult to find, you know, assets and investments that suit particular individual investors.
Yeah, it's a scary world out there. And I guess one of the biggest questions, and it addresses it in Gilding the Golden Years, is that how much money do I need to retire on? But what a scary question. What the dollar value is today may not be in 10 or 15 years ago. And let's say we pick a number and I'll just say I need $5,000 a month to retire on. Well, that $5,000 a month 10 years from now may not hold the same value as it does today. That $5,000 may be $1,500 today. So that in and of itself is something to look at that, Kevin, I don't think most people really take into consideration.
Well, you're right, and you really ask a two-pronged question, both of which are valuable. The first question is, how much do I need? What do I need in liquid assets? What do I need in the bank, so to speak, in investments to fund my lifestyle? And, you know, the most common answer to that, the easy, quick and easy, simple way to do it is to take liquid assets, multiply that number by 4%, and that's a pretty good rule of thumb of how much you'll be able to spend in a year, support your lifestyle, and that money should last indefinitely if invested properly. So liquid assets times 4%, if you have that much money invested or available to you liquid, it's a good start.
Let's talk about, and I think it's critically important, most people don't think about this, beneficiary forms. You know, and you're saying that the majority of those forms are wrong, and if you're gone, there is nothing you can do to be able to control the where those assets go to the people that you wanted them to go to.
Yeah, that's really an important issue. There's a famous Supreme Court case. A man named Bill Kennedy died and left approximately $400,000 in his 401k. Well, his daughter went in with the death certificate and asked for her check. And surprisingly, his former employer wrote a check not to the daughter, but to the man's ex-wife, not the girl's mother, but his ex-wife, his second wife. And the girl said, hey, what gives? Well, it turns out that 30 years earlier, he had gone in and put his second wife as his primary beneficiary with his employer on his 401k and had never changed it. And even when he was divorced, he died 7 years after his divorce, he still hadn't changed it. So even though the divorce decree, she had signed off her rights to that 401k, the Supreme Court decided she still got it because that beneficiary form had her name on it, not the name of his daughter.
Now, by the way, are you working with trusts at all?
I do work with trusts, Michael.
Yeah, I think I'm going to give you an I think, but I'm not in the financial industry. I think the trusts are so critically important today, and especially when you're going to plan ahead for what could possibly happen. The trust in and of itself spells it out. There's a beneficiary of the trust or somebody who runs the trust, and it can be changed if you wanted to, but it's right there. And the other thing I like about a trust, it eliminates, it bypasses probate because you can get in a lot of trouble and cost you a lot of money if somebody dies intestate without a will, without a trust, and the courts take over.
It is so important, but here's something interesting going back to that 401k. You know, a beneficiary form on an IRA or a life insurance policy or an annuity, they are not controlled by the trust. So the trust might say one thing, but if the beneficiary form on the IRA, for example, says something different, the IRA form will win out. So you're absolutely right. It's so important to keep trusts up to date. And as a side note, it's important to get a well-written trust because a poorly written trust is worse than no trust. But having a well-written trust, keep it up to date, and keep up with all your other beneficiary designations, something that at my firm, Berkwolf Management, we do at least annually for our clients because things change. People die, kids are born, people divorce, and so forth.
Well, one of the other things that a trust will do, and especially in today's real estate market, I'm going back through memory now, but I remember there was a part of a trust that had a step-up in basis. Step-up in basis meaning you buy a house for $10,000 50 years ago, and that house today is worth $1.5 million. Well, that you're going to have to pay the tax on that, the gains tax on that, the difference between the two. But if somebody dies, if one of the one of the spouses dies, then the other spouse gets a step up in basis. Whatever the current market value of that particular house in that area is, that's what the value is, and you don't get hit with that gains tax.
Yeah, and that's, I'm not an estate planning attorney, and that is a constantly changing arena. But the way you just described it is my understanding. You know, that's an important thing to be aware of. The other thing a trust, a living trust, will do is if a person has a large estate, and today the law says that large, they define that as $10 million, a properly constructed trust will allow a couple with that much money, which is a lot of money, yeah, they'll allow that $10 million estate to pass estate tax-free to the heirs. But the trust has to be drawn right. So I'm with you. That's an important issue.
Yeah, I think one of the most important things that we'll get off in some other areas that you want to discuss tonight, but one of the other things that happens is once the trust becomes the owner of everything. So if you die, the trust didn't die. The trust lives on, so it's treated completely differently.
It is treated completely differently. That's one of the things I address in my book, Gilding the Golden Years, you know, being certain that we actually remember to put things in the name of the trust. It seems like an obvious thing to do. Sometimes we think our attorney handles that. They really don't handle that. We have to be certain to do what you said. We have to make sure that the house is retitled in the name of the trust. We have to be sure if there's an investment account that it is retitled in the name of the trust. Otherwise, it can lead to some problems too. So getting the trust drawn up and then actually putting it on your different accounts and your different investments and assets, that's an important step.
And I think the other thing that could be a major problem with the families is which one of the kids do you put on as trustee, or do you have a couple of them on there as trustee, where the battles could start?
Ah, boy, there's a landmine. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've seen families blow up, even siblings that love one another, when one of the kids is named as successor trustee, or worse, more than one of the kids is named as successor trustee. And here's why. The first thing is that child is going to have to take a month off of work. They're going to spend their evenings, they're going to spend their weekends, they're going to spend their money, they're going to hire attorneys and tax accountants and so forth to be certain that they don't make mistakes, which could be liable for that. And all the way along, the other siblings, even if they're kept in the loop, wonder what's going on. Why aren't they getting their money? Why did they only get this so much? How come she got $10,000 and I only got $9,000? Whatever the situation is. So the American Bar Association says if you have over $500,000, first of all, you should have a living trust. And then my experience is to have a corporate co-trustee serve along with one of the children. It's not that expensive, and that corporate co-trustee will do the heavy lifting and make sure the tax filings forms are filed and so forth.
Okay, now, there is one thing that you were saying here. What's the big important thing to do before December 31st?
Well, December 31st, you know, we always think about taxes as April 15th. So, you know, on April 14th, I have sometimes dozens of people sending in their last-minute IRA contributions and so forth. But really, December 31st is even more important. And just to pick one important reason, the ability to harvest losses in our portfolio. So we might have some capital gains from sale of stock or a house or a property or whatever it is on one side of our balance sheet, which will be taxable. But if we can go in before December 31st and find potential losses, we would call them paper losses, if we can actually realize those losses before December 31st, we might be able to offset the gains and therefore pay less tax. So just there's one thing. There are others we could talk about regarding retirement planning and so forth. But just the ability to offset taxes, January 1st, it's too late.
Now,
so
by
December
the way,
31st is an important date.
No question about it. But one of the things that I'm looking at here, and I've got the answer to it before you give the answer, this how to steer clear of financial scams and identity thieves. I just got something from Nigeria that all I have to do is give them my bank account, and they're going to give me millions of dollars.
Simple. You didn't know it was that easy. Here we've been going to work, doing it the hard way.
Let me tell you. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say there's so many scams out there. You know, the one where the young person goes through the phone book and finds names that sound like an older person, and then they call posing as the grandson or granddaughter. It's so common, and I've had clients almost fall for it. I've had friends almost fall for it, and people do fall for it all the time, where the young person will say they need help, they need money, don't tell mom and dad, I did something I wasn't supposed to do, send $3,000 to Western Union, but please don't tell mom and dad, and grandparents fall for that all day long. It's really painful.
And the one which is very interesting, and I this has happened two or three times, when I say not to me, but it's come through in the email, and from people that I know in business, I've gotten emails saying I'm stuck in London and something happened to my credit card and I can't find my this, and if you could only send me X amount of dollars, let me just have it transferred from your account. And I mean, these are people, but it wasn't them.
Right.
That's where the problem is.
It would be so difficult to keep up with the sheer volume of identity theft scams and you know, and other cons that are going around today. We really have to be cautious. And you know, my book is designed really for seniors, retirees, and their adult children. And unfortunately, seniors are a prime target for con artists.
Oh, no question about it. By the way, let's talk about something that so many people run into this problem. I'll talk to people, I'll sit down, and they've got stacks of financial documents and information dating back for the last 20 years, and they're loaded with somebody across the desk here is laughing over here, loaded with stuff. When do you know to get rid of it? When do you say, pitch this, keep that?
Well, if you're a hoarder and a pack rat, which I could be if allowed to, you keep them forever. But most of us don't want to do that. So there are certain things that we do want to keep permanently. We want to keep our end-of-year bank and brokerage statements. So what I do for that, for example, is I'll keep January through December in a given year. And then when I get December statement, I throw away January through November. But I will always keep the end-of-year statement. So bank, brokerage, those types of statements you want to hold on to. Insurance records you want to keep permanently. You want to keep legal correspondence permanently. You want to keep cost basis statements permanently. In other words, you want to know what you sold something or you bought something for. If you sell it 30 years from now, you still need to have the record of what you paid for it and so forth. You know, I hate to say it, I'd rather hold on to everything permanently just because I know I can always look it up. That's my personality. But at least hold on to the end-of-year statements. Those are the ones that you can refer to and hopefully get all the information that you need.
But Kevin, how long? You know, like, for instance, there might be stock transitions that happened 6-7 years ago. There may be tax returns that, you know, you've kept for 15 years now, and there's only a certain amount of time to go back to, and the rest of it is just superfluous.
Yes, so that's such a good question. And I go back, I've gone to tax accountants and attorneys and asked that question. Frankly, I've gotten a different answer from every person I've asked. But the general rule seems to be 7 years with tax returns, that if you hold on to them for 7 years, you could be pretty certain that getting rid of them at that time is okay. But again, if you have a complicated situation where you might own rental properties, let's say, or you own a mutual fund. I have a client, he's owned the same mutual fund for 50 years. Mm-hmm. Things like that. Those, unfortunately, are records you need to keep. We need to know. We paid for them.
Okay, so, all right, now, as we're starting to finish this time up, big question, and I think it's a major question, the kind of a financial advisor that you want to look for. People, it's like anything else. Somebody gets a title, they get a label, and people treat them as the be-all, end-all. And a lot of times, Kevin, they're not. If I was to look for a financial advisor, what would I look for?
Boy, I sat back and I asked myself if I needed to find an advisor for my mom who lives in Ann Arbor, if I could no longer be her advisor, what would I do? And what I would do is I would go to the CFP, Certified Financial Planner, website, which is cfp.net, and I would type in my zip code. And I would start with 5 miles, and I'd maybe work my way out if there weren't enough responses, and I'd see if there were some certified financial planners in my neighborhood. And then I would look on FINRA.org, which is FINRA.org. That's the the body responsible for licensing stockbrokers. And on both of those, I would see if the people in my neighborhood that were CFPs had clean records, because their disciplinary history is listed on those sites. And then I would call them, and I'd see if their investment style made sense to me. Do they sell, you know, one type of investment only? Do they build portfolios? Do they work with young people, old people? What's their style? How long have they been in business? By the way, I want somebody with at least 10 years experience. I'd like 15. But if, you know, I was working with my mom, I'd say 10.
Okay, but what about somebody else? One other thing, not somebody else, but something else. What about, and I don't know if they could possibly do this because it's very quote unquote secret information, privileged information, that's a better word. What about a referral from a client or two or three clients that they work with of how they've been treated, if they're making money, if there's a track record there?
Yes, that is important. In fact, in my book, I have a list of 10 things to look for, and that is one of them, asking for referrals. They probably can't give you something right the first time you call them, but within a week, they should be able to come back with a name or two that has agreed to talk to you. And that person should have worked with the advisor again for at least 10 years, those referrals, before I would give them much credence. The other thing to do is to ask your CPA. CPAs are usually a good source of a good financial advisor.
Okay, so effectively what we're really dealing with is we're dealing with somebody who's had some experience, somebody who has experience in the field that you're looking for, and if they will give you some referrals, that's a good way to go.
Yes.
Okay, now, website we can find you at, get the book, and if somebody wants some consultation, to pick up a phone and call you.
My website is www.burk. I pronounce it Burk. It's spelled Bork, B-O-U-R-K-E, wealthmanagement.com. Or if they call my office, it's 1-800-673-0034. And if they call and ask for Melissa, I'd be happy to get a signed copy of my book out to anybody who's interested.
Wonderful. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's great information.
Great show, Michael. Thank you.
Okay, good night.
Take care.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, yeah, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Paula Johnson with us. She's the author of the e-book Marked, a novel that's a young adult thriller. It's a new young adult thriller. It's a fiction thriller. Just hit the ebook market. It's promising to be a very fast roller coaster and leaves you wanting more. Marked was the inspiration of Paula Johnson's recurring dream. And let's say, Paula, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, and thank you for being here. They hid out in Nome, Alaska, huh?
Yes, that is correct. Yes.
Okay, before we get to Nome, let me ask you this. The idea behind the book itself, you know, the reoccurring dream, what was it that triggered you? What caused you to put this to pen?
Basically, I tend to be plagued by reoccurring dreams that play out like vivid movies. And March was one of those dreams. Taking the dream and transferring it to paper has helped tremendously. And when I completed the novel, the dream stopped. It's a gift and it's a curse because every time you lay down, it's like Groundhog Day.
Oh, boy. Now, but let me ask you this also. Well, they took obviously their mark. They're getting away, but getting transplanted in Nome, Alaska. There's nothing there, and there's nobody there but a few natives and a couple of whales, and some polar bears.
Right.
Okay, but why did you decide Nome?
You know, it's a great location, I think, to hide. Certain areas of Alaska are still untouched, and especially when my characters, Alexandria and Marie, you know, they're from Southern California, and it's a hustling, bustling, you know, kind of town, and, you know, if you want to hide out, what's the best place to go hide? Alaska.
That's true. You could get lost real quick up there.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, by the way, okay, so they hide out. Now, the thriller, what is it? Is it about somebody's coming to get them, or is it just somebody, or is there something above and beyond? Is there something paranormal involved in it? Well, basically, how does the plot take itself?
Well, basically, Marked is a story of a family from Southern California who, you know, the patriarch of this family is an attorney. And he takes on some clients that, you know, maybe are a little seedy. And things go awry. And so basically the story is the after effect of that. And they're put into the witness protection program where they're being forced to relocate to Nome, Alaska. And, you know, they have to try and fit in. They have to appear to be not too mysterious and, you know, hope that this violent gang doesn't come and find them there.
Okay. Well, you know, by the way, at 50, 60, 70 below zero, that can happen in Nome, Alaska. I don't think I'd want to be a violent gang to come out and get them.
I would hope so. You know, I would hope not. I mean, it's a little chilly up there.
No question. As a matter of fact, it's really cold up there. But now this is the first book. Now, what are your plans? Are you going to start to do a series now?
Yes, absolutely. I intend to make Alexandria and Marie my primary characters for years to come. I think person's past always comes back to haunt them one way or another, and their past and their unknown future affords them a luxury of virtually endless adventures.
Now, by the way, you said that obviously it's a work of fiction, but it was inspired by your late mom, and she'd committed suicide. It was because of a failed second marriage, and she was a trophy wife at the time. What was the inspiration to write the book? Where was it from that incident? And I'm sorry that happened, but what was it from that incident that caused the book to become?
Basically, you know, I relate fairly closely to the teenage in this book, Alexandria. She went through a lot of, you know, trials and tribulations as a teen. Personal security became a major issue in my home. You know, there was always changes, you know, from time to time. You kind of never knew what was happening. And my mom, Diana Sullivan, was this young and gifted writer. And I think, like most gifted artists, they truly don't know how amazing they really are. And we tend to be our own worst critics. And I used to sit in her office as a kid and watch her type away on her old typewriter as she worked on her first novel. And when her second marriage began to fail, her self-esteem began to deteriorate very quickly, yeah. And it just became a fatal downward spiral. And, you know, being a young child and losing your parents, they mean everything to you. You know, they're your son, and you're just kind of orbiting around them. And, you know, you kind of want to grow up to be like them a little bit. And so she inspired me to write, even at a very young age. And, you know, I've always kind of dabbled in it from here and there.
Yeah, when you were writing the book, and obviously you said it came from recurring dreams, and so many authors run into the same thing, and I've asked the question probably 10,000 times if I've asked it once, but it seems so apropos. And here's the question, whether it be fact, fun, fantasy, whatever the case may be, anybody who decides to put something to pen begins to realize that there was somewhere in that novel or that fact, whatever it is, that they had this aha moment, this epiphany, this cathartic moment that they recognized something that they didn't know before. Where was that for you? Where was that moment in writing that you had to look at it, look at your life, look at everything around you, and realize something that you weren't even aware of?
You know, that's a good question. I tend to, you know, in anything that I write, I put a little bit of myself in there, a little bit of my own experiences, and I think that's pretty common with writers. There's a lot of my own feelings in the book. There's a lot of my mom in the book. I think, you know, as a child who loses a parent at a very young age, you're always holding out hope that, you know, maybe they didn't pass away. Maybe they're in some sort of witness protection program and they can't come and find you type of thing. So I think, you know, it has a lot to do with that. I think that's why I've been, you know, plagued by certain dreams. So it definitely, I think it has a lot to do with that.
Isn't it that point where people, they want to go hide? You know, even if it's in their own life and they don't run away to Alaska, they just want to hide. And I think that's something that a lot of people would love to do, and they do it in their daily lives, and they would recognize the running away is a hiding. Either somebody's forced to hide, or they just hide because they can't be themselves in front of anybody.
Absolutely. I think people tend to wear masks. You know, we all put up this facade, whether it's, you know, superficial, where you're dyeing your hair and you're putting on makeup and you're trying to be something you're not, whether you're really sad inside, you know, and you don't want anybody to know, or, you know, different things like that. You know, I think everybody would, at some point in their life, like to make a drastic change and start over. And, you know, I think that's what this book is, you know, about. It's about this young family who, you know, they're not ready to start over. You know, they probably enjoyed their life before.
Sure.
But, you know, things happen, and you have to evolve. And, you have to make the best of it.
By the way, not to tell anybody what the end of it is, if they want it, they got to get the book. But besides that, the new novel, how do you take them from one experience to the other? Because you said it's going to be about basically the same two characters, right?
Yes, that is correct. The new novel I'm currently working on is years in advance. You know, our young teenager at the time is now in college. And she's still kind of facing, you know, her old demons of, you know, not wanting anybody to know about her past. She still has to keep things secretive. You know, and you go through life and people ask you questions. You know, they want to know things about you, and you tend to have to be secretive a little bit. And, you know, it's trying to get over those feelings of, you know, learning how to trust somebody again, you know, being able to open up to them. And, you know, I think that's important.
Now, by the way, who's your target audience? Who is going to pick the book up and not be able to put it down?
Well, I have two teenage daughters, and, you know, they tend to be very avid readers. They love the Twilight series. They love the Hunger Games series. And I geared this book towards them, towards their genre, what they enjoy. And I have to admit, they did read it, and they loved it. Whether they were biased or not, they loved it. And, you know, so I think this is geared more towards your younger adults.
Did they ever want to eat again or not? They loved it.
Yes, they did.
if they ever want dinner again, you love the book.
Absolutely, that's correct.
Yeah. Okay, so we want kids that will really get involved in this, and I can imagine that what would happen as the kids grow, then the characters are going to grow. So really, the books are going to follow the life of your kids, not necessarily their everyday life, but their age, what they're going through at the time.
Absolutely. Again, major changes, you know, a child going through high school, you're still kind of the new kid, even though you've got kids, you know, some friends going into it, going off to college. You're the new kid. You get to start over again. And, you know, that's kind of how it's written. You're having to redo that being the new kid all the time.
You know, and that makes a lot of sense. Let me ask you this. We're just about ready to finish up. Is there a question that I did not ask you that I should have asked you that would have brought up information that the audience would love to hear? I think the plot's good, and I like the idea of following along with them, because they'll really be able to take a look at the book each phase of their life.
Right. I think it's important to, for me, I think it's great when I personally researched the Witness Protection Program. You know, there's a lot of information out there, whether it's actual factual information or if it's conspiracy theory information. But I think the most amazing aspect of researching it was the realization that you may not know your neighbor as well as you thought. You know, we all make, you know, decisions every day. And that one decision can alter your life and those around you for years to come. And I think readers will take that from that book, will understand that.
And that makes sense. Okay, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at and buy the book?
Well, my website is a little long, I will admit. But I'm on Twitter. My Twitter name is PD Johnson Author, and you can find the book on Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Wonderful. And by the way, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this.
Take care. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
The curtain's fallen. The music softly dies. But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is, there isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends,
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
We're parting out. out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the